From first appearances, Paulist father Bob O'Donnell is a University of Tennessee superfan. His office in the Knoxville Campus Ministry Center is glowing with orange. On the door is a poster of the men's baseball and women's basketball teams. It's signed by each player. Yet you might not often find Father Bob in that well-appointed office. He likes to be out on campus reading in the library or otherwise being approachable to students. He's a quintessential campus minister. I'm Jennifer Shveta Jordan for the Paulist Fathers, and I'm with Father Bob today in Knoxville. And he's agreed to share some insights from his life. So thanks for talking with me.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
Okay, so let's go back in time and then we'll catch up to Knoxville. Can you tell me a little bit about your life growing up?
Well, I grew up in Greenpoint, Brooklyn in New York City. And I mentioned Greenpoint because people there would mention they come from there. Pretty heavily and still Polish-American neighborhood, immigration, 20s, 50s, 70s, 90s, with a mixture of other people, obviously some Irish, or I wouldn't have the O'Donnell name, and some Latinos. Very Catholic environment, 98% of the people Catholic. It was like the only Protestant I knew was in our Catholic school, and Jewish merchants, but they didn't live there, but they were good friends. School I went to, Catholic school, and then not too far away, a Catholic high school, St. Francis Prep, but even in the grade school, on Fridays, you'd get a quarter to go around the corner and turn on the lights in the synagogue. There was a nice relationship in the neighborhood so that somebody from the congregation wouldn't have to do that work, because flipping the light switch is kindling a fire if you're strictly Orthodox, and we were happy to do that.
Not permitted on the Sabbath.
Yeah, we were happy to help out the neighbors next to our school.
Cool. And I liked your story this morning at Mass about the family, were they Ukrainian?
Yeah, they're Ukraine. And it's pretty obviously a Ukrainian Polish name.
Would you tell that story again?
4th of July, 1956, I know the year because we had a car finally in our family and not a lot of people in the neighborhood did. And my father's setting off firecrackers, fireworks, and the neighbor, Mr. Shimko, my father, John O'Donnell, get into a big argument. It is noisy. Don't be doing this. This is in the afternoon. Now, this was not even in the dark. And they get into a spat and words go back and forth. And finally, my father says, if you don't like this country, you're unpatriotic, go back where you came from. Oh. Nobody's talking to each other for a couple of months after that. And then in the fall, once it was Saturday, because my father was home during the day, Dad comes rushing into the house, grabbing the apartment car keys. Mr. Shimko is sick. And you might have heard me say, oh, you little kid. All right, good. We got him. Let's have a party. No, no, no. My father goes out, putting Mrs. and Mr. Shimko in the back of his car to go to the emergency room of the local hospital. Wasn't much ambulance service where we were. And suddenly, my father could do no wrong, no matter what he did. And he's Johnny. And kind of a great reconciliation, because my father treated someone he was at odds with well and generously, and they very generously accepted that help and brought about a nice healing. And the families knew each other. We knew his daughter and son and daughter-in-law. But ill feelings can come up when those kind of battles come around. So,
a nice story.
Yeah,
of,
love your enemies. That's what always strikes me. And I wouldn't say he was an enemy, but close enough to it from a child's point of view.
So siblings?
No, none. My mother almost died when she had me, and that was the end of reproducing in our family.
So that's unusual for the Catholic families, maybe? No.
Catherine Shimko, granddaughter of the Shimkos, was an only child. This was not unheard of in our neighborhood. In fact, not many of the families had large numbers of children. Two, three, city dwelling, apartments, life is limited. And mothers needed to go to work to have enough money coming in to pay the rent and buy a car. It was a necessity. My mother and others would stay home till you got to the first grade, and then you're gone during the day.
Tell me about how you came upon the Paulists.
In the sixth or seventh grade, a teacher, who is a school sister of Notre Dame, mentioned Catholic Information Center in Manhattan, run by the Paulist Fathers. So I put it in an essay I had, and then I had an encyclopedia, which was American and New York oriented. So it wasn't a big expense, but it had an article on the Paulists there. Oh, very interesting. Started in New York, and they study in Washington, and dedicated to a mission in the United States. And that clicked in my head. And then in high school, so I'd go over to the Paulist Church in Manhattan, and I subscribed to the Catholic World, which the Paulists then published. So it was kind of a slow building up of an acquaintance. We're not in a Paulist parish, and in fact never had Paulist as mission preachers, though some teachers I had in high school, Franciscan brothers, knew of the Paulist and were, you know, pretty positive about that. But so I waited to the end of high school. So this is 4 or 5 years looking around the edges, and then, you know, let's take the plunge and applied. And back in those days, the Paulist ran a college-level seminary.
Not the junior seminary.
Yeah, junior.
Baltimore?
St. Peter's College in Baltimore. And I think I was the last or next to last class through there. And simply not worth it financially for most dioceses or orders.
So why did you want to be a priest?
Well, I think it was to serve Christ, to follow Jesus, to serve people. And I was always interested in the faith and learning about the faith and doing something. I was in a Franciscan Third Order group when I was in high school. And, you know, you do once a month, play basketball with poor kids in a neighborhood, and you'd have a monthly meeting with prayer. So it was always there. But it's that combination, God, Jesus, people, all together.
Was there anything, or is there something now, that appealed to you about Paulist Father Isaac Hecker?
Always. His story I liked from the beginning, and you know, his kind of spiritual search and journey, which is interesting. We're putting up quotes during this anniversary of his birth, 200th anniversary of his birth, and I noted to Father Don today, all the quotes we put up so far are from his diary. He wasn't even baptized when he wrote the diary, but it's very spiritual. And it fits with a Catholic point of view, the God, the Holy Spirit, can be working through and in many people. And his conclusion was where he would find the best home that didn't emphasize his utter sinfulness. And you shouldn't be looking within yourself to find God, because there's nothing, as many preachers then would be saying, utter sinfulness. And you know, Catholics say there's goodness there, but that you need Catholic community, faith, belief, sacraments to solidify that, but that would be accepted and recognized there and not much else. But he went on a nice searching journey to New England, to the Transcendentalists, you know, Alcott's and Bronson's and Henry David Thoreau and those people, and then became a Catholic after that. And the story doesn't end there, because he's a Redemptorist and then splits from the Redemptorist, and it's quite an adventure. And I liked his attitudes too, that in his writing. Writes about evolution, for example, and says, well, yes, we grant God gave human beings a soul, but the body can evolve from lower forms of life, which would be a standard 20th century Catholic answer. But he was
ahead of his time.
Clear. Yeah, there are other Catholics who said that too, but let's not look for conflict where there is none. That was also an attitude of his that I liked. Well, we've talked about democracy or the American experience. Then the Catholic faith and people who have it see what is good in it rather than this is the danger and this is the enemy. He would have said they go well together.
And with evolution, you maybe that appeals to you. You're like a science guy.
Yeah. And of course, we were taught straightforward evolution in Catholic high school in the 1960s. This continuing controversy about it is kind of strange to see. In fact, my high school biology teacher said, and maybe God managed to evolve the soul too. He just left it at that. Mm-hmm. So interested in science, so I was struck by that. It was also why I took a liking to Father Don Andrew when he came to the seminary, because he's a techie and science person. And finally, we had a student who knew some of this and could converse with him and learn from him. But other things like democracy and Hecker didn't say a great deal about it, but how can people expect to earn their bread by the sweat of people they've enslaved? He did talk about that. Not much, because Catholic Church didn't want to split as other churches did over slavery, and so people didn't shove their views across the Confederate boundaries. The statues were in your face, you people better remember who runs this region, the state.
You and I, another little piece of history, you and I were talking about that Paulist origin story comic book that's been reprinted recently I don't know if it's from the 50s or the
1950s, okay. Probably 57 or 8.
And that last bit in it, you pointed out to me about the relationship with
his
Hecker's
sister-in-law.
His sister-in-law, okay.
Josephine, married to his brother George. Mm-hmm. And just a little panel in it, but it's surprising for two panels for the 1950s. I've had in mind a task for you. And she says, What could I do? Oh, you're going to be in charge of the children's division. I think she was a teacher publishing Catholic books for children. And you're the editor of that section of it. It was called Catholic Publishing Society at that point. And now they probably say, why not make her editor of something bigger or whatever? But that then just struck me as, using talents. And His brother George was paying for everything. Mm-hmm. The family had prospered, and George had become a Catholic, so he supported the early Paulist. And Josephine was very talented and actually helped with the work in a way George couldn't. He could write checks and offer housing on occasion.
The Holy Spirit is so important to the Paulists. You're wearing the pin with a dove image. How has the Holy Spirit been part of your life? Is that something you can define?
I would tend to look at the Holy Spirit in terms of the Spirit of God leading me to Jesus and following Jesus. So it's probably more Jesuit spirituality. But there's no defined Paulist spirituality. You must do this, you must do that. It's let the Spirit guide you, and so all the Spirit of Jesus and his ministry and after, and how he lived and how he asks us to live. So I would tend to put it in those terms rather than great revelations in silence. Hecker was more focused on the Holy Spirit alone because he came out of a background where they talked about the universal spirit and philosophy in Europe, and so this is the Holy Spirit, and Jesus was in there, but I kind of flip it around. Like Nepal, the Spirit is active even in the religions of the Far East, and he was very clear, maybe not perfectly, but who they are and what they are and how they pray and live has been influenced by the same Spirit. And that makes more sense there because they're not talking about Jesus. They have their own take on it. So even there, he was really ahead of his time. He would have said, and eventually the Spirit's preparing them to become Christian and Catholic, but they're not all lost or in darkness. They're ready, as he was before he was even baptized, living in the light, a certain light from God. Not unique, but advanced for his time. There were others in Europe that he read who would have echoed what he was saying. Mm. And he read widely. He read and he read all of his life. He kept up with especially theology from Europe.
What have been the highlights of your priesthood?
That's a hard one because it 13, 14 assignments in different places and many good things in all of them.
Well, when we talked on the phone before, you had said just campus ministry is...
Yeah. But not necessarily any particular one. I mean, some good things. I was featured in the University of Connecticut student newspaper once with an interview, and McAllister College interview. I might say serving at McAllister College when I was in Minnesota was particularly cherished, maybe high point for me. I was also at the University of Minnesota and worked in several parishes in order to bring in an income. But McAllister is a Presbyterian-affiliated college whose student body is overwhelmingly not religious. If you got all the Presbyterians together, you could get them into a car. I mean, it was just, and the chaplains there realized that we were there to minister to a very liberal or post-religious student body, and they were very curious. They weren't anti-religious because neither they nor, in most cases, their parents had any. So of 2,000 students, all the religious students would amount to about 400 or 500, and then 100, 200 practicing. So tended to do things together. Catholic, regular Protestant, evangelical retreat together, paid for by McAllister. Catholic retreats paid for by McAllister. My office, my parking space, the chapel. They'd assign a sacristan to set up for Catholic Mass, who was often not a Catholic. They had a book with pictures, so the person could do it as a work-study program. So it was a good place. And staff meeting meant the Presbyterian head chaplain, she's now at Harvard, a rabbi, a Buddhist chaplain, et cetera, evangelical person. And that was staff meetings, because nobody had a staff except each other. And one secretary for the whole group, and plan things together. And the head chaplain was always very solicitous that the Catholic community or the Jewish community are prospering. This was important to her, important to the college, to attract people, but also because she simply, and I think the Presbyterian connection, valued the religious expressions that were there.
So campus today, we saw you interacting all day long with students. You went to the baseball game. You were giving people high fives or fist bumps,
ended
I guess.
Up sitting with two students, a recent graduate, another student.
And then there was a guy seeking you out downstairs when I came. So how does your interaction with the students, I guess, bear fruit on the campus? Or can you talk about, can you share any anecdotes of why it's important for you to be here as a Paulist and as a priest?
With the few people I've met, and, oh, you're a Catholic priest. I was thinking about being a Catholic. I would get the names and give them to Deacon Bob, and then they may or may not go to RCIA, and always tell them that's not a commitment. You're just seeking, and we're not going to rush you, even if you want to rush, because 18, 19, 20-year-old decisions might be not the wisest. Somebody who's 28, 29, married to a Catholic, all right, you're already baptized Lutheran, that can move along more quickly. And then I think just generally being of good support to the different groups I encounter, going to student events. There's one student I know who's a vice president of the campus event board, so I try to go to the things that he has. He's occasionally at church. Somebody said, oh, he's got a lot of questions now, so I'll contact him and say, you want to have lunch together? But he's doing good. He's serving out there, and you got wonderful students who serve mostly here, gather in community up here, pray in the chapel, meet during the week, and that's wonderful and needed. But others who are on the campus and doing things there are involved with a fraternity, a sorority, or a team, and don't have a lot of time to spend around church other than maybe one event and Sunday. And it might bear more fruit later on in their lives, as opposed to sending forth marginal, alienated Catholics. I might send forth slightly practicing positive Catholics. and that makes a difference. And over the years, I've learned that. A lot of people who are not particularly active in college might later on, married and family, find a church, settle down, become very active. That may be less so now. As most of the people who are going to stop going to church do so well before they hit college. Here they're coming back if they're making any moves. There might be a small percentage of freshmen whose parents have kept them going to Catholic Church Mass or Lutheran or whatever right through high school, and they come here and drop it all. That's pretty rare. Most parents give them freedom by the time they're 13. And our bishop has said he thinks the average dropout rate is actually somewhere near the end of elementary school. So important to kind of extend a welcome to people and have contacts because there are people out there. Even if we have a couple of hundred Catholic students here, there's another several hundred more on campus, even though it's not a very Catholic campus. Though I think the campus is more Catholic than the state, because you don't get on this campus unless you go to a rich suburban high school or a Christian academy or a Catholic high school. The education would be relatively so poor in most of the counties that unless you're really extraordinarily intelligent and family and parents, you're not going to make it to the main campus. It's for people who've had the advantages as well as the ability to be relatively high achievers. And so you get more Catholic high school families and middle class immigrants from the north, Protestant academy people, evangelical academies, and then rich suburbs have great high schools and they're here.
So what are some of the most challenging parts of your priesthood?
Oh, I think dealing with differences in the church. People have pull you one way, pull you another way, want to tell you exactly how you or everybody else should be or not be, and that's always difficult because you got to hold together a whole, even in the average parish, a whole set of people. They're different pieties, different points of view, and you can achieve a uniformity by driving out a whole set of people, but that's certainly not anything I would want to do or anything in the Paulist spirit of inclusion. And a Catholic Church is a kind of big tent, includes people of quite a variety of views.
Yes, I always have to remind maybe myself or others that it means universal.
Yeah, exactly. Catholic, big C and small c, universal. And if people disagree with some standing official or traditional teaching of the church, people shouldn't just overthrow it because they don't like it, but they shouldn't be thrown out either. This is going to stay this way, maybe for good, maybe for a while longer. But you're welcome here. I respect what you think. You've made some good points, or some cases their points may not, may be somewhat idiotic. I don't know. There's a group in town, I think of Catholics, who want to reestablish a Catholic monarchy for the U.S. Like, this comes right out of Europe.
For real?
Yeah. Well, they have a flag and everything. And it's a movement in Europe of some Catholics, some fascists, who are not particularly Catholic, but think it's good if you have the Catholic Church established, because it keeps people in line. One of their leaders was excommunicated before World War II. Reestablish the Catholic Church in France. Put down all these revolutionaries and all these liberal tendencies. Well, I don't believe any of it myself, but it's good for France. And actually was excommunicated, kind of using Catholic belief and life for, it was a fascist movement, Action Française.
That's what it's called locally, too?
Who knows where they got their stuff from, Austria or somebody.
Okay. Wow.
And then there are Protestant equivalents for Restorationism and a theocracy in the U.S. But so you got a little bit of everybody around. Not in this parish, though.
How have the Paulists influenced you?
I think in all situations to be compassionate towards people. Whatever your view about what they think or what they've done or how they approach you, to be compassionate. May not mean agree, but to be compassionate. There was a long-term saying back some years ago, people would talk about their problems in the church. Go to the Paulists, they'll give you a break. Meaning they're not going to come down hard on you or send you out the door, resolving never to come back. They'll listen and try to walk with you. And that's an important lesson. Whether Paulists are very traditional, and I've lived with some wonderful traditional Paulists, old or young, or of other outlooks, that's a fairly universal thing. And I suspect you picked that up a lot from Father Tim. We're not there to make people toe a line and let them know they're failing, and that instead hear their stories and journey with them and offer them what we can and listen to them. They may be right.
I'm always impressed with the academic opportunities afforded Paulus. Can you talk about that? Some of the you've gotten a couple degrees along the way.
Yeah, well, of course, seminary. I closed out St. Paul's College, too. St. Peter's, St. Paul's. But it was accredited and everything, got a master's degree in theology. Then while I was working at the University of Connecticut, got a master's in American history, doing it part-time through 3 years. So, and then in the early 1990s, a doctorate in religious studies at Catholic U, where for 2 or 3 years I was more or less full-time in that, but then after that, part-time as vice president of the Paulist and trying to finish up and better get that thesis done, you know, the ABD, all but thesis, ABD, all but dissertation, so managed to do that. And, you know, it was a great opportunity to learn a lot about religion in the United States, because that was my focus. And they had then a religion department separate from theology department. Now it's religious studies and theology combined, but the religious studies part has some theology in it, but a lot of, you know, sociology, anthropology of religion, a lot more examining religion as it is and historical perspective. So it was good. It was a good opportunity. So I'm grateful for that.
I don't know if you can sum this up, but what over the years has appealed to you about Catholicism so much, you know, from a young age?
Yeah, I think you put your finger on it, kind of the universalism, the big tent. There might have been a point early in high school where we got the truth, you don't. The Pope is God's representative on earth, period, and we're building God's realm. But I, even halfway through high school, Vatican II's going on, I read books about it, broadened my view. And I had teachers who did this in high school who were gently nudging me in a certain less rigid or authority-centered direction. So that helped. So even before I got to the seminary or seminary education or theology, that was already a trajectory I was on. In fact, one high school teacher, Jack Monahan, layman, was very influential. I'll just put it that way. And he was our debate coach, and I was a debater. And my high school had every semester you had a speech course, all 4 years, speech communication. So you'd see him once a week, but you saw him again and again. And he'd always take us over to the Catholic Worker in Lower Manhattan. We're there at a debate club meeting, and all right, you guys, get outside. We're going into my station wagon. You could squeeze 7 or 8 boys into it. Going, well, where are we going, Mr. Monahan? You'll see when we get there, across the Williamsburg Bridge, Christie Street, then the Catholic Worker in their earlier location. And he points over to there. You see that woman? It's Dorothy Day. He said, remember, you have seen her and met her. You'll realize someday how important this is. So Jack was a pretty extraordinary man this way. On the way to Holy Cross in Massachusetts, he would stop at the monastery in Spencer. We'd be there for evening prayer. You need to see this, a different kind of Catholic life. So he was very enriching. I kept up with him for years.
Did you talk to Dorothy Day?
It was just hello. And then I did see her once some 15 years later, maybe.
Speaking or something, you mean? Or?
Yeah, she was at a demonstration.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
With Cesar Chavez.
Ah.
No, it was more Jack just saying, remember who she is. You've been here. You've seen her. You've said hello or shook her hand.
Wow.
Someday you'll know how important this was. Because we, you know, he liked to refer to us, you dumb heads, dumb little idiots. You don't know anything. And then he talked about the church's social teaching while he was driving along.
Yeah.
You don't know anything. Well, actually, we did. But and he's expounding this, but it was good. He was a good influence.
Has life as a priest been different than you expected?
Yes and no, maybe more no. More yes than no. I didn't think I would be so much constantly, regularly in basically parish or parish-like situations. I thought maybe academic or teaching or something like that. But close one institution, close another, move here, move there. That became less of an opportunity because then you're not staffing a place where we have responsibility. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know if I ever thought about campus ministry early on. I might have thought of regular parish, but quickly got into that and plunged into it, got used to it, and then loved it. And Berkeley as a deacon, University of Connecticut, and then MIT, and then Washington Catholic University, New York administration, seminary and administration, and then Minnesota, McAllister, Berkeley again, and here.
You spent some time at Guest House. Tell me about that.
2005, I decided I needed some help with the ever rampaging alcoholism, and I actually called them up, got Paul Smith. I called them up, they had a space, and I went. Of course, the Paulists are paying for this, and it's not inexpensive, and had a couple of months there, and it's very enriching and does what it needs to do. I realize some people don't like that. It was AA-based, and some people get all in a lather over that, but I think that's perfectly good approach to it, and good community there and good counselors. And it was in Minnesota. They've closed that branch, just have one in Michigan now. But I ended up staying in Minnesota, came back to New York, packed up, and moved to Minnesota, and was quite happy to do that. Had kind of taken on Minnesotan accent, so to speak, by being in Rochester, Minnesota, and then followed it up with Minneapolis.
That experience of going through the recovery process, like, what does that bring to your priesthood, do you think?
Even heightened compassion for others and their struggles, but also, frankly, a commonality with a lot of people. Oh, you use phrases or something day at a time, or use the, oh, you're in the program too. And that can be a nice bonding among people to support each other and wherever you go.
Do you have a favorite way of praying?
Yeah, I'd say reading the scriptures and praying over them. And I actually like the Psalms. Praying the Psalms. Those are powerful prayers. And then sometimes kind of just silence. But a recourse to the scriptures, I think, is very helpful for me. Again, back to Jesus. And the Spirit speaks to me through gospel accounts, especially about Jesus and his words.
Stolat, that's the Polish way of saying 100 years, right?
You live 100 years.
Yes. Well, I hope that happens for you. But when the time comes, how would you like to be remembered?
I've written my obituary, by the way.
Have you?
Oh, yeah.
What's that?
Eric asks all of us, President Eric Andrews has asked all of us to do the newspaper blurb.
Yes.
Not the Paulist
anthology
or whatever, and your funeral homily, but something that could go into a newspaper right away. But, compassionate, loyal to the Paulist community and doing things in and for it, and good intelligence and sharing that with others without lauding it over people. Especially the long-term loyalty and caring about the community. It's over 54 years from first setting foot in a Paulist house. So one of the lifers, as they call them. Other people bring other experiences. I bring a memory of what things were like in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and met priests who were born in the 1800s then, who were around and retired and then dying off as so it reaches back pretty far. Frank DeCiano in Washington would be another person like that. And Jack Collins in New York.
Father Vinny?
Yeah, he's another lifer. Mm-hmm. And then he was also on the seminary staff in Baltimore when I was there, so he and I reminisce a lot about that. And we knew people. We read these necrologies daily on the anniversary of someone's death. But a lot of times I will have met the person and knew something about them and will say something about them, and that kind of highlights it. Like Cappy. People didn't know, why is he wearing an eye patch? That was World War II. Stuck his head out of a tank to save a wounded German soldier. And whether it was a setup or not, got shot the eye, wounded, and went around the rest of his life looking like a pirate.
Yeah,
he was a bit eccentric, but this was a testimony. I hate those people. It's you got to be brave and you got to be compassionate, and I don't have any regrets about doing that.
What are you most grateful for?
Individuals, the people, many people in the Paulist and in some of the parishes I've been in, individuals and people. Don't have contact with a lot of them in a lot of parishes. It's too much moving. Usually your first or second place, and Good Shepherd, Upper Manhattan, was my first place as a priest. There's still a lot of contacts, even though we don't serve there anymore. And Paulist, I always tell people, it's the finest group of men I've ever met. Sometimes we know what our mission is, sometimes we don't. I think we're more clear on it again now. But a fine group of people who do a lot of very fine, wonderful, and interesting things. Don't ask me what the mission is. I don't know. I would have said 8 or 9 years ago. Now it's getting back to the original thing of bringing people to Christ in his church or back to their Catholic roots in the church, and doing it with a lot of compassion and openness, not beating people over the head. They have a good openness there, and I think we embody that. And that was kind of our original mission. And in 1960, most people were going to church in the U.S., not really, but it seemed like it. And you're not going to run around and bring people out of a Protestant pew into the Catholic Church unless they ask it. So, drop all of that. Well, it's all flipped around again, and it looks like 150 years ago, a country where quite a substantial number of people have no religious attachment or have kind of faded out of being Catholic or something else. So you're not sheep stealing. You still have good ecumenical relationships with people who are in other communities. But there's a real need for other people to find some inspiration, faith, following Jesus more in their lives. And I'd say more because I think a lot of Americans have some basic Christian notions that they live. That'd be a Paulist attitude. It's not all corrupt and evil and idiotic and dark out there. There's a lot of goodness around in the society, and that's God's work.
Well, thank you so much for your time.
Well, pleasure, and thank you for being here in Knoxville on the way to no particular other place.
I've been speaking with Paulist Father Bob O'Donnell. I'm Jennifer Shveta Jordan for the Paulist Fathers. We'll have a companion video and written content from this conversation, all available at paulist.org.